Colonel Kaloff.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. And Mr. Anderson. Mr. Kaloff, as soon as Mr. Anderson can get himself comfortable down there. And so you may approach the podium and tell us if you want any time in rebuttal, please, sir.
3 minutes, please, Your Honor.
You have 3 minutes.
May it please the court, my name is Vassal Califf with the Virginia Beach Public Defender's Office. I represent Shantrina Fountain. A very brief overview of the facts in this case. My client was pulled over by an officer for a very minor traffic charge. She pulled over immediately, was then directed for officer safety purposes to pull into a parking lot. The nature of the parking lot is the entrance part to it was well lit. A portion 2 to 3 car lengths into the parking lot was very poorly lit. Upon my client going into the parking lot, she begins to approach the dark portion of it. She feels something's not right here. I don't know why these officers are telling me to pull into the back of a dark parking lot. She then reverses her vehicle and reorients towards the officers and stops her car near the officer's vehicle.
Counsel, let me sort of focus on one thing that I'm interested in, at least others may not be, but they'll tell me so.
Yes, sir.
I can see that she might have had a subjective concern given the circumstances that, but once the sergeant comes, I'm concerned with what happens after that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Where there's then another officer on the scene, so that if any fear or concern that she might have,
I do understand the concern there, and I did address it at trial, and it is in the brief where, in the closing argument, I stated we aren't here to really to rule on the reasonableness of her assessment of the situation or whether the officers had some sinister intent of some sort. It's whether she actually was legitimately in fear at the time she placed her 911 call. I think even if she was unreasonable, which I would not concede, I think the whole lead up to the situation where an officer says, I'm going to drag you out of your car, pepper spray you, she has a 9 and 11 year old daughter with her. And I don't have children. I don't know what it's like to be a single mother. I would not be able to crawl into the mind of my client and see whether she was reasonable under the circumstances. But I don't think that's really the issue. I think the issue is, did she call 911? Did she cause the phone to ring with the contemporaneous intent to delay, harass, hinder, or annoy emergency personnel? And I think that's should be the main focal point. Whether she was being unreasonable or not, as the trial judge found.
So you think that the crime would be completed if and only if at the time she initially made the call, she intended to disrupt the 911 system?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe under the plain language of the statute, it states very specifically you cause a phone to ring with intent to delay, harass, hinder, or annoy. I think the plain language of it is very clear that there is a specific act causing the phone to ring, and remaining on the telephone is not causing a phone to ring. I think that the main focal point should be when she caused the phone to ring, did she have that contemporaneous intent? Now, my main argument ends up being a bit of a hybrid argument. It's sort of a statutory construction argument, and I believe it was preserved and argued at trial. In my opening brief, page 12, it does show that I made a motion to strike at trial. Evidence did not prove beyond reasonable doubt that the defendant possessed the requisite intent when she placed the call. That motion was renewed. That's on page 15. Pages 15 through 16 in the closing argument, I further articulate in arguing that the evidence presented did not prove that the requisite intent was present at the time the emergency call was placed. So I think the court had ample
opportunity. If I'm understanding, it's purely statutory that if at the time she called there was no intent to annoy, there was an intent to place a concern that was occurring and she needed help.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then after that, no matter what happens, you know, she wants to call an attorney. And then, you know, the sergeant comes in and tries to calm her down, but she won't get off the 911. And my question is, if I'm understanding your argument, then if it was made initially without any intent to do anything but to seek help to cause it to ring, then whatever happens later in regards to the 911 call is irrelevant.
In terms of the way the statute's worded, I would say that it is under 18.2429B. Perhaps there's another crime that or another charge that could have been brought. I'm not sure. Maybe it could have been an obstruction of justice charge or something else. But I think what we have to focus on here is the plain language of how that statute's worded, and it's very clear. And there's nothing to indicate that the legislature meant anything other than when the emergency phone is caused to ring. And I find that to be curiously worded myself. And I'm not sure why the legislature decided in their infinite wisdom to word it that way. But the fact remains, my client is charged with causing a phone to ring with a specific intent. And the trial judge indicated that he did believe she was genuinely terrified when she placed that call, and that the intent was later developed at some point during the call. So, I mean, it's a situation where I just think under the plain language of the statute, she cannot be found guilty of misuse of 911. And the reason it's a bit of a hybrid argument is there's a statutory construction aspect of it. If this court was to agree with that argument, then we naturally, the next step would be, okay, well, what did the trial judge find? He found that she did not have it. It was undeveloped at the outset of the call. No reasonable trier of fact can say that a person who did not have that intent developed at the outset was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of all the elements. And that ends up being the crux of the argument, Your Honor.
Counsel, do we look to objective or subjective belief on the part of the individual that she was afraid?
I would believe it would be subjective. It would be a very specific intent for her to have. She has to intend that. If she doesn't have that intent, then we're missing an element for the charge, Your Honor.
Figuring out that subjective intent, we look at whatever the evidence is.
I would agree, Your Honor. I would say I believe the Commonwealth cited Epperly as one of the cases where premeditation can be found due to what happened during an altercation. So it's basically X happened during an altercation, therefore, based on X, we can find that Y actually was the mindset at the outset of that altercation. But I don't believe that's the case here, because the judge in this case specifically stated that at the outset it wasn't there. So we can't retroactively place an intent where there wasn't one just based on the actions of a person during an encounter and based on the facts that came out at trial. Without that intent, when the call was placed, there is no reasonable trier of fact who would have been able to find that a person was guilty of that offense.
So it's just plain black or white?
I would say the statute should be construed based on its black and white language.
It either was or was not at the moment you placed the call. And then from then we would have to, it went 37 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor.
So then the length of the call would be irrelevant, but if she kept them on the phone for an hour and a half, still no crime.
Still no 18.2429B, Your Honor. I believe that is a very accurate assessment of how this law is worded and how the facts match up with the law, and we're missing an element. And the trial judge stated himself that we do not have this element at the outset. I find, taking all the evidence in, being able to observe all the witnesses, that she was legitimately terrified at the outset, and she called because she was terrified. The intent was undeveloped, so in a position where we don't have an element, and that's to be dismissed. Unless the court has any other questions, I mean, I guess it sort of cuts to the chase with the argument. That's the main point.
Judge McCullough, Judge Decker, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Still have your rebuttal time.
Right.
Mr. Anderson?
Good afternoon. A few seconds. May it please the court. This case probably illustrates the fact that you can have appeals that don't involve pretty heavy-duty felonies such as murder, rape, or robbery and still have an interesting legal issue, which I think this case does. I have three basic defenses to the defendant's argument. And first of all, just point out that he himself doesn't say that his construction of the statute makes much sense in terms of the reach of it. I mean, I think you read probably two or three weeks hardly go by without me reading something in the paper about someone calling CNN or whoever, and after a few seconds it becomes clear they're calling on behalf of that great intellectual observer, Howard Stern. And the call quickly comes to an end. Now, for all I know, you've had similar calls to 911 services. The point is, something there that's plainly a prankster calling, plainly would violate this statute, but ends within a few seconds because the fact that it's a prank becomes immediately apparent. That would violate the statute, but this defendant being on the phone for a total of 37 minutes under the circumstances shown here by the record would not. I think that's an extraordinary result, and the court...
Why is that? I mean, why wouldn't the General Assembly want to encourage people who initially have a legitimate concern to call? And then if it turns out it morphs into suppose they think it's a burglar. And so, look, if you have a burglar, rather than take the law into your own hands, reach for the gun, call the police. Well, then it turns out it's your drunk neighbor, and so the situation's diffused, but the caller is upset by the reaction of the dispatcher or whatever, and it turns into this hostile phone call. Well, one, the General Assembly might want to encourage people to call in that situation because there's a legitimate fear at the outset. And two, police can just hang up. They don't have to put up with this, right? So you had an initial concern, ma'am, you're upset, but too bad, this is a waste of our time, just hang up.
Well, they could have, but in this case, it was pretty clear that they were trying to diffuse the situation, to try to get her to cooperate with the police on the premise at the scene. And just put it in more simple terms, there's the fact the General Assembly might want to encourage someone to make a 911 call hardly brings about an equivalent conclusion that they wanted that person to hang on for 37 minutes, even after 12 minutes into the first call. A supervisor of the one of the officers at the scene came there and assured her, there's no problem here, you need to cooperate with the police so that this can end. And she said several times that she wanted to record this whole event. And I think the Commonwealth, I think it's reflected in the statement of facts, talked about she wanted to use 911 as basically her recording service, which I think manifestly is not something the General Assembly wanted or wished to encourage.
But the best way we figure out legislative intent is by plain language. The plain language of statute is cause to ring. So that suggests not a continuing or a new intent at some point during the call, but rather at the outset of the call. And maybe they need to write a different statute.
Well, they may. And to be honest, in my experience in statutory construction cases, if the appellate court reaches one result, they invoke this series of principles. If they reach a different result, they invoke these principles, and it's up to the court, the deciding entity, to decide which of those group of principles is going to be trotted out. All I can say is I understand. I would make exactly the same argument that the appellant is making, that no matter how ridiculous this result seems to bring about from this construction of the statute, the words are there. But again, I have three defenses. First, and this case a perfect example of why written statements of facts are such an unfortunate substitute for transcripts. Sufficiency arguments, like anything else, are critically bound with the precise language of the arguments at trial. The fact that the sufficiency of the evidence under statute is attacked on one ground by no means necessarily means it's attacked under another. We've cited this Supreme Court case, Floyd, where the argument was sufficient to show that the defendant argued that there wasn't proof of one conspiracy, but there was insufficient, there was no sufficient argument attacking the fact of seven conspiracies. So the language pertinent to a sufficiency of the argument issue is critical on appeal in terms of potential default. The statement of facts here, I'm certainly not going to say that this statement of facts proves that the specific statutory construction argument advanced on appeal wasn't made, but I will say several things. One, it's the appellant's burden to provide an adequate, complete statement of facts if that's the way you're going to proceed. And as a parenthetical note, this certainly falls under the category of it's easy for me to say it, but in his reply brief at page 3, the defendant talks about that it would be difficult for him to, as an indigent, representing an indigent, to obtain a court reporter for a transcript. All I can say in response to that is it makes the adequacy and the completeness of the statement of facts all the more paramount. In this case, there are several things of note in the written statement of facts, and it had been such a simple, easy thing to do to have the statement of facts say in unmistakable language what's in this brief, which is, under the wording of the statute, the corrupt intent must exist at the time the call is placed, and if it doesn't exist until thereafter, it doesn't violate the statute. There's nothing that I think adequately shows that, and indicative of that is the fact that the statement of facts, which is lengthy, does not have one reference to that particular statutory argument by the Commonwealth. It doesn't have one specific reference to that argument by the trial judge. That seems exceedingly curious if that statutory construction argument was advanced with specificity at trial. I can't understand why there would not be any reference to it. And the judge at the in the statement of facts in his verdict basically says in so many words, well, she may have been terrified when she initially placed the call, but thereafter developed the intent. If that statutory construction argument had been advanced, that seems a remarkably truncated verdict where he says nothing about, I understand the defendant is arguing this, but I find that, and then go on to convict him. There's nothing. And one final thing on the statement of facts, and I'm in the same position as the members of the panel. I wasn't there. I am totally at the mercy of what the record shows. The brief in opposition by the trial prosecutor who was there, which, you know, is not something the court has to take as gospel, but at the bottom of page 5 it says, in the present case, the defendant did not argue statutory construction and did not raise an objection to Judge Croshaw's ruling at the conclusion of the case. Either that's an accurate description of what happened, an innocent but incorrect description of what happened, or a not so innocent mischaracterization of what happened. But again, that was what the trial prosecutor said in the brief in opposition. All right.
Can I ask you make sure I'm not missing something. The trial court said that although not possessing the intent at the outset, basically, that she developed an additional intent to perhaps intimidate the officers. So the court talks about intimidate. And the statute says annoy, harass, hinder, or delay.
I think two things.
Does intimidate fall within, I mean, it doesn't fall within delay necessarily, doesn't necessarily fall within hinder. I don't think annoy. So then maybe harass is tantamount to intimidate. I'm just trying to square. I mean, because you get the benefit. You're in a strong position because the Commonwealth prevailed at trial. I'm just trying to make sure the court's findings square with the statute.
Well, Judge McCullough, two points. One, and you've alluded to the first one. The judge is speaking extemporaneously. This is not some written opinion where, upon some reflection, issued X number of days afterwards. He's speaking off the cuff. I certainly would regard intimidation as equivalent to annoy, harass, or hinder. Beyond that, the defendant has never once raised this point. He's never said, furthermore, even the verdict itself.
Right, but one of the things we have to be careful when we write these opinions is not to create more messes. So I don't think it's a base for reversal. But we have this specific statement by the trial court, and so at least when I write these, I try not to open a new can of worms and just resolve what's before us.
Well,
that's what got me to thinking about this.
Right, and I noticed language that to me, in an ideal world, and if I were, by some extraordinary development, a judge considering this, the language seems to me, it's not particularly helpful that it has this language. She certainly developed an additional intent to perhaps intimidate. I mean, again, but the point is that's extemporaneous language. That's what happens when people are not writing from a script.
Go back to Mr. Anderson, and what is troubling to this judge is that at the time the call was made, was there intent to cause it to ring, to annoy, harass, or do anything else? Now, I think that the evidence shows that the longer it went, the worse it got.
Right.
From her standpoint, but if we are in the statutory interpretation bound by, did she cause it to ring with the intent to hinder or annoy, that she is mad at these police officers, first of all, for pulling her over, and then rings it, but there is this long term of just acerbic language back and forth of what's going on.
Which goes to, and if the court were to say the language causes to ring means we have to reverse, no matter how ridiculous under the facts of this case that may seem to in terms of the resulted sanctions, so be it. But several things. One, again, because it would set up this otherwise indefensible distinction between these quick calls that were plainly done with the corrupt intent versus here, 37 minutes, where she's repeatedly told that officer in the marked police vehicle is legitimate. You need to get off the phone. We need to end this matter. Sign for the traffic tickets and you'll be on your way. And she says, I want to record it. It has to be, the court seems to me, under rules of statutory construction, just to feel like it has absolutely no choice but to sustain this argument. Second, again, that's putting aside the adequacy of the written statement of facts that at no point ever refers to the Commonwealth or the judge addressing the statutory construction argument.
The judge signed it.
Right.
Under the rules, so it is what it is.
Right. And his finding, I agree, it basically on its face suggests that when she first, just before the first of the 37 minutes began to peel off, she called because she was terrified. But then he says, in so many words, she developed the requisite corrupt intent thereafter during that 37 minutes. I think it's important to point out there's not just one phone call here by the defendant. There is a second phone call. And if I can turn to that. The second phone call is at page 8 of the appendix, which is part of the statement of facts. And by that point, she initially spoke, according to page 7 of the appendix, she spoke with a dispatcher for about 20 minutes. About 12 minutes into that 20 minutes, the officer at the scene, his supervisor, Officer Sergeant Creekmore, arrives. And he's trying basically to end this incident. This goes on for a while. And then, according to at the page 8, said the 911 dispatcher who had made attempts to end this call, but she persisted in staying on, and I suppose the 911 operator could have clicked, but he didn't, and I think that really doesn't get her off the hook. But in any event, said the 911 dispatcher agreed to transfer the defendant's call to her supervisor. However, the attempt to transfer did not successfully connect, and the defendant called back for the sole purpose of reestablishing a connection with the dispatcher's supervisor, and then that went through. That may have been her sole purpose, but if by that point the bad intent under the statute existed, then there's your causes to ring. The phone certainly rang at that point, and according to the judge's finding, she already had the requisite corrupt intent by that point, because when you look at the bottom of page 12 and top of page 13 regarding the judge's verdict, said, Judge Kroshaw ruled that while he genuinely believed that the defendant initially felt terrified during the encounter, the fact that she did not get off the phone when Sergeant Creekmore arrived on the scene, as well as the fact she remained on the phone for 37 minutes, showed the intent. The point is, she called back after Sergeant Creekmore had showed up, and Sergeant Creekmore was part of the basis for the court's conclusion that she had the requisite intent. So there's a second phone call, and if the defendant is otherwise right on the statute, you certainly have the phone causing the phone to ring with the second call, and the intent precedes that. unless the court has any, and the sufficiency of the evidence is almost entirely driven by the statutory construction argument. If the court doesn't sustain his argument, then the evidence plainly is sufficient to support this intent finding of fact by the judge. Court doesn't have any.
Is there any indication in the record, and I recognize your concern over the record, but is there any indication in the record that the trial court was relying on the second phone call as opposed to the first phone call when it ruled?
It's certainly silent one way or the other on that.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
The only indication of the court's reasoning
12,
would be the 13. Would be the paragraph beginning at the bottom of page 12 of the appendix.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. We appreciate your argument.
May it please the court, Your Honor. The issue with the statement of facts, that's just the reality of doing a misdemeanor appeal docket in Virginia Beach. I handle sometimes 20 to 25 misdemeanor appeal cases in a day. They do not supply us with a court reporter, and it's very difficult to anticipate which cases are going to need one.
Yeah,
so.
The statute that says that, you know, the statement of facts, I think the rule is once the statement of facts is signed by the counsel and approved by the trial judge, it is what it is.
Yes, Your Honor. I think this...
Counsel, let me just ask you this, though. If you're going to rely on a statement of facts, which the court allows you to, and it's proper within the rules... isn't it still the appellant's obligation or the petitioner's obligation to preserve for the record that the issue was in fact preserved and adequately stated? And if so, where does it say that specifically in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. In the multiple areas with the motion to strike, the renewal of the motion to strike, and the final argument, I overlooked this the first time around, but it does say in here the argument was made. As I guess I mentioned part of this, defendant's not being tried for reasonableness of her assessment of the intentions of the officers, rather for causing the 911 line to ring with the specific and contemporaneous intent to annoy, harass, hinder, or delay. So I've said it three times in three different ways, and it's reflected in the statement of facts. And I feel the court had ample opportunity to consider the argument that that's how the statute should properly be construed. The fact that there's nothing in the record to indicate the Commonwealth wanted to respond to that, I'm not sure why they didn't, to be honest. It's not in the record. Maybe they thought they had a slam dunk without even addressing anything I'm saying, but that was their choice, and they signed off on this statement of facts, as did I and the trial judge. This issue about a second phone call, there is nothing in the record to indicate that the trial judge relied on a second phone call of any kind. At the top of page 10, it says, dispatcher agreed to transfer defendant's call to her supervisor. And this is a dispatcher saying, okay, I will transfer your call, but the transfer did not successfully connect. And both parties stipulate the defendant called back for the sole purpose of reestablishing a connection with the dispatcher's supervisor. Consequently, thereafter, successfully connected with the supervisor. I understand the court's concern. Why didn't she hang up after the sergeant showed up on the scene? She should have known better. I can't crawl into her mind. I'm in a position where she was legitimately terrified, and I just didn't have the intent to delay, harass, hinder, or annoy. This issue of saying, I want this recorded, and the Commonwealth saying she's trying to use 911 as her personal recording device. Well, that's part of it, but the other part of it is she repeatedly says, I don't feel safe, something is not right here, they're threatening me with violence, I have two children in the car, I want this recorded, I want to speak to my attorney. This is a woman who's panicking, she's freaking out, it's reflected in the statement of facts. And what are you going to do? You want this recorded. You want to make
sure
you're safe.
Not everybody has the same trust in police officers that perhaps they ought to have.
I would, me personally, being a...
I'm just making a statement as a general proposition that
right.
For some there are many in the citizenry who take a more adversarial view of the police than maybe they have. That's all
for the record. I like
it was
police.
Friendly. It was a friendly comment.
Right. But
no, we understand, and I think the point was that we don't know what drives people in their fear or angst with police officers, and that's not really.
Yes, Your Honor.
You have some more time, but if you're finished, we'll be glad to come down and greet you.
No, I save the court, unless the court has any other questions.
Straightforward.
You guys just want to chat.
Straightforward case it is. Thank you very much, counsel. We'll come down.